Welcome to a new episode of Policy Implications Podcast, where policy meets research. I'm your host, Olga Zadrozhna from Kuzminsky University, where I teach in the research in empirical economics. My guest today is Melanie Menchue, who is an assistant professor at New York University, Abu Dhabi, and an expert on the role of values, beliefs, and norms in shaping economic and political disparities. Today, we'll be discussing her recent paper called Folklore about oral traditions, such as stories, beliefs, and customs, being a powerful measure of contemporary attitudes towards trust, risk-taking, and gender norms in modern societies. The paper is forthcoming in Quarterly Journal of Economics and is co-authored with Stelios Michalopoulos. So welcome, Melanie, and let's get started. Firstly, I'd like to say that I'm a huge fan of this paper, and I think you've done an amazing job with it. But before we discuss it in more details, please tell us about your research expertise and how did you become interested in the topic of folklore and how it may be related to our modern beliefs.
Thank you, Oha, and thanks for inviting me. So, this has been a long-term project. So we started this around 2017, both because we are interested in the role of narratives and stories. So my co-author at the time had a newborn, so he is the person actually to tell the stories to the children. And me at the same time, I've always been interested in thinking about how does this So in the case of China, we have those phrases that are commonly used in everyday life are similar to proverbs, but more concise. So often we have, we just encounter the use of this language. In some sense, you can think of this as a cliche and a lot in the everyday life. So it's been my thinking that, wondering how much of a role they play, given that they actually have been used over the generations. And then sometimes it's a common plot. So things happened a long time ago, and we don't even know if it was true or false, but somehow it was just get told as stories. So those are the events or circumstances that triggered me and my co-author to work on this project. And then very fortunately at the time, I was also visiting his university, and then I was just doing some kind of a little digging, and then noticed there's this data set has been compiled by Yuri Berensky, who's a very prominent folklorist, who spent his whole life compiling this catalog, which includes all the stories from all over the world, which is really amazing. Yeah.
And so how do you define folklore? So what do you mean by folklore?
So folklore is actually, it includes immense body of literature. So I think a key distinction between folklore and other types of writings we talk about is that it has to have been the oral form for a long time. So all the stories we include and we examine are the kind of things that's been passed through the word of mouth. So instead of thinking about classical literature, which is obviously a product of intellectual product of the elites, it's mostly be just in the elite circle. The folklore, the things that an average person or ordinary people, when they were illiterate, and you can still be telling the stories. I think it's the most compelling when you think about ethnic groups in a relatively isolated and small societies. And folklore to them is almost like often it plays the role of a religion, and it explains the rules you have to follow and where your ancestors come from. So these are the vessels I'm most interested in. So in terms of data, I think we use, as I mentioned, we use Yuri Berensky's catalog, and those are the stories that have been collected by anthropologists who have done the field work and by going to those small isolated societies themselves. So the definition, I would say, you can imagine it being really broad, also included like dance and singing, but for us, we mostly include stories, but stories that was not written down for the most part of its existence.
And were there many differences between those stories, between different ethnic groups?
Yes, so it's interesting because there's a bit of a both. So the way we measure it for each group is we don't really measure the entirety of the folklore directly. Like we we mostly by trying to understand each single story. But the way the catalog is composed, it means you can know, you know, there's like 2,500 stories at total in the world, but different ethnic group will have a very different a pick of those. So some ethnicity might have this 500 stories, and then as the other ethnic group, you know, 500 miles away, or have like this 200 stories, which can be actually of a completely different nature, but they can also be overlap. So most likely you'll have two ethnic groups that have 100 stories in common, but then one group has 400 stories and of its own, and then the other group have like another different set of stories. So it'll be very different. So some groups will have a lot of stories. It's all about tricksters, and you know, the tricksters, and has bad consequences happening to them, and other groups might just have very few of those. So what we do is trying to count the share of the stories and the entire value of a folklore this group has. So that's our basic method. So based on our observation, they're very different. So even just at the superficial way, and thinking about European stories and Chinese stories, usually you'll have very different emphasis. And so that's what we've been seeing so far.
And so basically that's very interesting what you are saying, because indeed our stories are our fairy tales. They're meant to teach the children something, right? So for example, if we are talking about the Red Hood story, that's basically a message to our children, don't go to the forest because there is a wolf that potentially can eat you, right? And so probably different ethnic groups, they do have these kind of like similar motifs in their stories. So how do you measure this folklore? How do you construct your measure?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very good question. So this is one thing that also took us such a long time, because thinking about to properly measure the stories and to differentiate them from each other, it's not an easy task. It's often we run into the question of how different would be different. Good thing about this data set is when it at motif level, it's actually quite distinct from each other. So for the motif, it's already been constructed in a way to represent the smallest unit that persists. So what we need to do is just to measure that unit. So you have 2,500 motifs around the world. So what we do is just to try to measure those 2,500 units. So instead of thinking of thousands, tens and thousands of stories that are all different from each other, we focus on those 2,500 smallest units in the folklore. So what we end up doing will be to trying to first to, so there's two approach. So one is a more of a technical approach. So this involves way to count the words. So just literally they're looking at the motifs and looking at what kind of words there is in each of this, usually two to three sentences per motif. And then by counting words, you end up having the issue of just having like a zillion words, and then like how are we supposed to think about it. So nicely, there is like this tool called a concept net, which we really use. It's like a knowledge graph, which helps us to reduce the dimensions. So instead of counting at, presuming there's like at least 20,000 commonly used, well, semi-commonly used English words, we end up counting just at a somewhat higher level and see like how many of those motifs can be represented by just those most common set of concepts. So it's like one concept will be overarching up to 50 words. And then if any of those words get picking, and then we end up having this concept being elected for this motif. So on the whole, I mean, the concept net approach is very nice because it's quite objective and mostly unsupervised. It allows us to find out what motif is about forests, what is about the ocean, and what is about the snow, as long as it has words related to those key concepts. But on top of that, there's also the Mechanical Turk and so we're all the people who are doing casual work on Amazon, and they have helped us to read these motifs and understand if it's about, you know, it's about honesty and how they view women and how what kind of life, what consequences the tricksters faced. So there's two parts. I wouldn't say either of the message is superior than the other. I think those are both very important messages to this project.
So you've analyzed the text in your stories to determine which stories relate to certain norms that you were interested in. And so then you had to connect folklore to the ethnographic records of countries. So how did you do that? And what are your main findings there?
Yeah, so when we do this link, we mostly focus on the ethnographic atlas. So this is like a very commonly used data set, but also has a few drawbacks. So this part of the purpose of our data set is to complement the current mainstream data set used in economics research when it comes to ethnographic information. So what we do is that first we have to link these groups. So a group in this Yurin Berensky catalog is not always the same as an ethnographic atlas group. So we have to build a bridge between the two so that we can find these two groups and match them together. Once we do that, this is actually very similar to what we had in the first part of the paper, because instead of now we look at if this is about forests and then this is a place where there is a lot of forest. Now we look at if the place with more motifs about, say, kings and the political elites, are they indeed a place that was historically politically more centralized? So then I think that's where the ethnographic records comes in, because we have to see if there is a match or there is a mapping between our folklore data set and this ethnographic atlas data set. So our main finding is we have noticed there is a lot of parallels. So it looks like this existing data set, it seems like a very useful source as well. But then with that understanding, then we can use the folklore data set to infer these traits when there is missing values in the existing data set. But also there is no mention of any of those traits in this existing data set at all. And that's when I think the folklore data set is the most useful. So to summarize, we have main findings. We have noticed these groups that has stories about the elites are the groups where it's politically more centralized, but also the groups that talks about the spiritual entities and how they punish and award certain behavior, and are the groups where you see the existence of high gods. So high gods are, I think it's been discussed in other literature, are the people who societies who believe there is a god that is overlooking them and punish certain behavior versus others.
And so after that, after you've connected folklore to ethnographic records and probably filled in some gaps, then you had to connect the folklore to the contemporary attitudes towards trust, risk-taking, and gender norms that you look into. And so how did you measure those norms, the trust, the risk-taking, the gender norms? What were the main measures of those?
So for this part of the paper mostly rely on a human interpretation. So you ask talkers extremely simple questions. So you would look at the questions and they will be presented with the motif, and then they will have to tell us if this motif about, you know, women is being portrayed as submissive, or, you know, men being portrayed as dominant, or they're seen as like intellectually competent. So those are very measurable, and it shouldn't be any doubts. So we're not asking them, oh, do you think women are presented in an equal or favorable terms as men, but rather we ask them, what do women look like in these motifs? And then they ask those questions, and we can aggregate their answers. And then we know based on literature that if a society always portrays women as very reliable until men, then those societies tend to have less equal gender norms. So once we do that, then we know what are the motifs that portrays women in more equal terms to men. And then we compare it with same societies where people answer those questions and the world value surveys or the global value surveys, and then see if the answers are comparable. What we have found in general is that there has been quite a lot of persistence in these attitudes. So in order to see if this is actually about cultural values, I think we also do additional checks, such as if the same pattern can be found at the ethnic group level. So the main results is at the country level, because world value surveys and the global preference survey is mostly conducted at the country level. But we also do a little bit just to look at the ethnic group level when the data exists, and we find a very similar pattern. And then we also look at the immigrants. So this is where we use for, especially I think the main immigrant survey data, right? In Europe and the US, so one can compare the second generation immigrants, say if they're coming from certain countries, do they still exhibit the same beliefs as their home origin countries people do? So if they still think women are less equal than men, just because two generations ago they migrated from China, and then I think this could be a cultural evidence that there is being the transmission of the cultural values from the parents to children. So that said, I think we are still very far from knowing exactly whether folklore is the transmission mechanism or not. It's just we are more confident that this seems to be something related to the cultural beliefs that is going on.
That's actually very interesting. And so in terms of the mean policy recommendations, should we pay special attention to myths and stories that we tell our children, and will they affect the way the economic norms are formed?
Yeah, this is something I'm thinking about a lot. And I think there has been some recent discussions about this. Because we are increasingly more aware of the role of the narratives, then one natural thought is that they should do something so we can have a better society. So I think I have a mixed feelings about this, because it's true that I think it is definitely right. There is an improvement over the status quo. There are stories that's been told to children without much of awareness, and those could be stories that is full of sexism and racism, and I think people should be more aware of that. And in the case of China, as I mentioned, we were actually asked to recite those old stories and to try to use it in our composition as school assignments as much as possible, but we were never told what to use or not to. So in some sense, it's true, like this kind of emphasis on the knowledge, especially that kind of part of the oral traditions, which could be seen as rather harmless, but they can actually produce side effects. So many of those phrases are really just a summary of a malicious intent, which probably has perpetuated some of the negative beliefs that we have among ourselves. So yeah, so I think my view is it probably should be at least at the individual level in a more decentralized way. It should probably be included, incorporated as part of our knowledge about our historical past, and then people will pay more attention to what they do and what they say. So that would be my view on this. So in general, I mean, I don't know if you're aware of this Carl Jung's view about folklore. So his view is that folklore is actually often represented a more disturbing aspect of the collective unconscious expressed through archetypes. That tells us why some of this can be quite worrisome, could be vehicles of certain values that is no longer desirable in modern society.
Yeah, so we should be conscious of the stories our children read or hear, right? Well, we'll put a link to your paper in the description box so everyone who's interested in more details could read the paper. Thank you very much, Melanie. It was a very interesting discussion, and it was a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, Alha. Thanks for having me. Thank you.